I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Joanne Roberts joins me now. She's written a new book that's especially timely, Storm the Ballot Box, An Insider's Guide to a Voting Revolution. It's an engaging book that offers solutions to combat the apathy, ignorance, and frustration a lot of citizens feel about democracy itself, and it's written with the experience of a 40-year reporter who left journalism to run for political office. She was a candidate in the 2015 federal election in Victoria, B.C., running for the Green Party, and then in elections of 2019 and 2021 in Halifax, Nova Scotia. She shares her experiences as a candidate in those elections, showing the reader what it's like financially, personally, but more importantly for the campaign. She takes aim in the book at strategic voting. It seems to be what most of the parties are urging voters to do in this election. Joanne's view is that voters should vote for who they think would best represent them rather than against a candidate or a party or a particular leader. We'll talk about fixed election dates as well as polling and misinformation emanating from political parties. There's a lot in the book that's worthwhile to consider and doable. Joanne Roberts is an award-winning journalist who spent 20 years as a CBC radio host. She is the former interim leader of the Green Party of Canada and in some was a candidate in four elections. She has an MFA in creative nonfiction from the University of King's College. This new book is from Nimbus Publishing. We spoke yesterday afternoon with Joanne joining me from Halifax. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Joanne Roberts. Joanne, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you. I was telling you before we started in an email I sent you a few weeks ago how much I enjoyed the book because not only give us ideas about what to do to change the system and our habits as voters and citizens, but you also offer great reminiscences about the campaigns you've run, the first one being 2015 in Victoria. When you look back at that and I've always wondered this about, you know, with candidates. How long after the election's over do you stop blaming yourself for losing, say? I mean, did you keep thinking about what you could have done? I mean, is that something that you still think about even?
I do. I think I'm over the blaming and the guilt. But, yeah, I think when you lose an election like that one that went well, especially right now, because there's a bit of a feel in 2025 that was also there in 2015. In other words, people are voting out of fear. They're afraid someone's going to win, so they're voting for someone else. So that brings back, how could I have countered that then? As you say, 2015 was my first election, the first time I had gone from someone who covered elections to someone who was actually running in one. And I realize now how much I didn't know. I mean, I had great campaign managers, thank heavens, and they put up with the fact that they had a candidate who was really, really naive. So I think that was the big thing. But the big takeaway is, you know, I should have knocked on more doors. And I'll bet you if you ask every candidate that's lost that really thinks about it and identifies what they could have done differently, they'll say the same thing. I was great at debates, and I thought debates were everything, and it was my strong suit. I think I had 19 debates in 2015, but I realized those are great. You should do them. I'm a firm believer that people should get to hear their candidates speak, but you have to knock on doors, and I should have knocked on more of them.
You tell a story in the book about your daughter who did seek office, both federally and provincially. She was called by the two other campaigns in one race I can't remember what was said now, to avoid going to schools?
Yep, they felt, and look, you hear this, going to schools, especially for school debates, right, takes time, and it takes time away from knocking on doors. So there had been a number of requests from schools, so the Liberals and the Conservatives, and this is in 2019, called the Green campaign where Claire was running and said, look, if all of us agree not to go, then that would be better because then no one will be criticized for not coming in. We all know that kids can't vote, so we should just knock on doors and this will be to the benefit of all of us. And Claire said, no, I'm not going to agree to that. But what happened was the Liberal and Conservative didn't show up some of the time. The Conservative didn't show up at all. Mm-hmm. So it became the Green, the New Democrat, and I think it was the Animal Rights Party. Like, you know, it really was the parties that I guess didn't really think that would stand a chance of winning. And yet, I can't imagine a better group to speak to during an election campaign than students. They are going to be the voters of tomorrow, right?
Yeah, that's the thing that I came away with in one of the great prescriptions you give in the book about how to develop, say, political culture and encourage young voters. Because I still remember in high school, candidates that would come to our class and things like that. And you think about, you know, what it's going to be like when you get to vote in a couple of years or so. And that's terribly important. And I think that I can't help but admire your daughter for doing that.
Well, thank you. Yes, she's a pretty strong individual. You know, I was signing books this week at a chapter store, and a mom came to talk about the book, and she didn't know what it was about, and we talked a bit. And her son was standing next to her, and I said to him, "How old are you?" He said, "I'm 14." Mm-hmm. And I said, do you have any interest in politics? And he goes, "Well, I'm interested in the world." You know, and he was a very quiet young man. And His mom said he's really quite smart, and you know, he's not going to tell you this, but I think he is interested in how our political system works. She decided to buy a book, so I said, "Well, why don't I make it out to your son?" Mm-hmm. Because I'd like him to read it. And so I made it out to this young man. And a few minutes later, he came back to my table. He was holding the book, and he said, "You have, you know, an endorsement in here from David Suzuki. I saw him once. He was so impressive." And I thought, you never know what's going on in a young person's mind, right? Mm. He walked away holding that book in a way that would make any author's heart swell. And I thought to myself, I hope this book helps that young man be a voter in, you know, 4 years' time.
Yeah, it's incredibly important because, you know, we look at voter turnout. We might be happy with, say, the advance numbers in the last week or so. But voter turnout, even in 2015, though it was high, it's still not where we'd like it to be, right?
No, and I have a bit of a theory about the advance polls turnout, and we'll see if I'm right about this. I do think this election has more people engaged.
Yeah.
But both Friday and Monday were holidays for most people.
Right.
And I make the case in the book that we should have our elections, we should make the day of our election a holiday. I think a lot of people went to vote because they had the time.
Yeah.
Right? And I really do think we have to start looking at the very basics to encourage people to vote. What makes it easier for people to vote? Yes, they have to be engaged. Yes, they have to see it as an important election. But they also need to know that, hey, you know, I've got today off. I've got some time. I'm going to go and stand in a line, you know, at an advanced polling station. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I voted on the weekend, the Saturday, because I knew that on Monday I'd be busy and I wouldn't have time. And in case it was busy at the poll, I would be afraid to miss, you know, voting because I had somewhere to go. The other thing that people brought up about these advanced numbers is they're wondering if it's just people who are inclined to vote just do it earlier.
I do think that's true. I think that committed voters want to make sure they get the vote in the box. The other thing is parties are really, really pushing it, right?
Mm.
Here's the thing. Again, looking at the back end, if you will, of what's going on in the party's minds. So they knock on your door and you say, "Oh, I'm thinking of voting for, you know, A or B or C." And they know you could change your mind if they leave it to chance for the next 5 days.
Mm.
So parties have seen a real advantage in getting those votes in the box and locking it down in case anything goes wrong. Someone makes a mistake in the next couple of days, or, you know, there's a change in the sort of zeitgeist. So parties have become really, really adamant that their volunteers all vote early, yes, but they also want people who are supporting them to vote early. So I would say there's a good chance that it, probably 4 to 5 million of that 7 million is a committed voter.
And you mentioned voting on a Saturday. We do that here in British Columbia municipally, and in the last provincial election, it was on a Saturday. And I think that that's also important. As you said in the book, that it should be a holiday.
I think it should be a holiday, and I also think it should be a community celebration. I just think we've got this impression that voting has to be a drudgery. You know, I was listening to some great interviews being done in the lineups of advanced vote voting, and I loved the fact that people were talking to each other. There was a little bit of, oh, we're doing a good thing and we're here, as opposed to, you know, this is awful. And I think we could take that one step further. You know, in Australia, where they actually have compulsory voting, you have to vote in Australia, and their turnout is, you know, 93%. It's a national holiday. They get all the not-for-profit groups to put on barbecues, and, you know, it's a celebration. You can plan on seeing all your neighbors at the polling station. You're encouraged to bring the kids. You know, there's ice cream. I think we need to change sort of our approach, our impression of what voting is, to encourage people to see it as something you wouldn't want to miss out on.
Yeah, that's a great idea. One of the things you tell us in the book to not do is vote strategically. Now, we're hearing in this campaign that, and all the parties seem to be doing it, except probably one or two, to keep a particular party out, one should vote strategically. What's the case that you make in the book about not thinking about voting strategically?
There's two. One of them's more interesting than the other, but the other's very important. So the first reason I say that voting strategically skews our voting system is that you have people voting for something that's not necessarily aligned with their values. They're voting, as you said, to prevent someone else from winning. And we now have a whole slew of online websites that are helping people do that, you know, Smart Voting, Vote Well, Cooperation. And, you know, so three sites out there that I can think of that are trying to help people do that. What's interesting about that is their polling data is all over the map, in fairness. So if you looked at their polls early on, those polls have changed. If you'd voted early, you might no longer be voting strategically. There's a handful, maybe two dozen ridings in this country where it is critical to vote strategically. There are other ridings that it is very clear who's likely to win, and people could vote for what they actually believe in, and then we get a sense of where people sit on the political spectrum, as opposed to seeing a landslide for one party and just because they oppose the other party. Then it becomes a two-party system, which is not how ours was designed. The other thing, and people don't know this, I didn't know it as a reporter before I became a politician, if a candidate gets 10% of the voting of the votes in their riding, so 10%, that's not a high bar, they get a rebate 60% of what they spent in the riding, so the cost of their office and the cost of those signs and whatnot. So what does that mean to a riding and to a candidate? It means that they can then have a little bit of money to start getting ready for the next election. And every candidate gets it, but you have to get 10% of the vote. So what's going to happen in this election is there's going to be a real push to the two major parties, and people aren't going to vote, say, for the NDP or the Greens or the PPC, and those parties are going to find themselves without the funds necessary to build for a future election. So that 10% is key, and that means you need to convince 10% of the population not to vote strategically necessarily, but to vote for what they believe in. If they don't believe in you, well, that's one thing. But if they're only voting, and I ran into, you know the stories that are in the book.
In 2015,
so many people in 2015 that said, well, I'd like to vote for you, Joanne, but I have to vote for your opponent because I don't want the Conservatives to win. And I went, the Conservative hasn't got a hope in you know where of winning in this riding. You do not have to vote to stop the Conservative. The winner is going to be either me or the other guy from, in this case, the New Democrats. Oh, I don't know, Joanne. You know, and I did get 32% of the vote. The Conservative was way back and beaten. But I think of the number of people who voted, who may have wanted to vote for me, but who didn't. They end up with what I call voter remorse.
Yeah.
And then they get frustrated with the system. They may decide not to vote next time. I had this young woman in Northern Ontario say to me when I asked her if she was going to vote the next day, it was before Election Day, and she said, no, I'm not going to vote. And I said, well, why not? And she said, I'm not smart enough to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? That broke my heart.
Yeah.
I said, of course you're smart enough to vote. She goes, no, you have to read the polls. You have to know who's going to win. You have to figure out how it's going to. I said, no, you really don't. You just need to go and look at the people who are running and decide which one you feel is the best person for this riding. And that's when I realized all this talk about strategic voting and polls and pundits, and, you know, I fall into that. We're all making people feel like if they can't figure out who's going to win, then they shouldn't vote at all.
Yeah. That's a great story that you tell in the book about that lady in Northern Ontario, because we all know people who think like that.
Yeah.
And who would just avoid voting just because they say, well, I haven't really looked at their platforms or anything like that, which is not really how a majority of people vote, right?
Exactly. And you know what? I've been reading way too many online stories this week, but, you know, people are starting to say now, do platforms really matter?
Mm.
And I think, well, I'd like to think they do, but on the other hand, when you're releasing your platform in the last week of the campaign,
yeah,
I do wonder, do platforms really matter, right? Because, you know, as we know, there are 7 million votes in the ballot box, and one of the major platforms wasn't released until Tuesday.
Yeah. You mentioned this 10%, getting 10% of the vote, and then getting a rebate once you pass that threshold. I guess in Victoria, the Liberal had dropped out in 2015.
Yes.
Or was forced out, I guess. I can't remember the exact.
The party withdrew and said that she would not be allowed to sit in the House of Commons, but it was past the deadline to get her name off the ballot. So her name was still on the ballot, even though she disappeared. She did not continue to be actively campaigning.
And so you thought when that happened, when that story broke at the time, that a lot of those voters, the Liberal voters, would go to the Greens.
And, I did.
Yeah.
Fool me.
And then you found out because of this rebate afterwards that they ended up just voting for themselves. These are usually party members, I guess, right?
Well, people who are, strong core. They call it, you know, in the lingo, it's the base.
Yeah.
She got 12% of the vote. She was an excellent candidate in many ways. She had made a couple of, I would say, really poor errors of judgment on her Facebook and social media, but this was back when we thought we were talking to our friends.
Yeah.
Anyway, aside from that, she got 12% of the vote, and I was absolutely astounded. I thought, did people not hear the news?
Yeah.
And then someone just sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, Joanne, the party wants their money back.
Mm.
And I went, what? You would use your vote just to get a rebate? And that's when I realized the value of that 10%. And, you know, that's a riding where they could, that party continued to have an active riding association. While they hadn't won in the next two elections, it looks like they might win this time. So that's the value of being able to keep your riding association going, to stay active with your members. Like, that's a big part of what our political system should be doing. You know, when you talk about political culture, it's good to have people coming together between elections and talking about what some of the issues are and saying, is the government doing a good job? Should we be looking at something to address this issue? For only having these conversations every 4 years, then we do end up with just a horse race and who's got the best ads or the best signs. And I think it would be better for our political system and for the culture in the country, especially if we want people to be engaged, if we were having, you know, even meetings on issues held by parties that people could go and have a discussion about housing or health care in between elections. And that's where that funding comes in handy. It also means that if suddenly you have a snap election and you have to buy signs and you don't have to go out and instantly fundraise all of it. You have a little pot of money there to draw from.
Yeah. The one thing you talk about in the book that I found really interesting, and you offer an idea as to how to combat it, and we'll talk about that. It's this idea of misinformation and what should be done in terms of, say, combating that or mm-hmm. even sanctioning it if it does happen in a campaign. But one of the things I've been seeing on my Facebook feed in recent weeks, and more so in the last week, say, because the election's a week away, are polls that are being shared. And it's usually a photograph from 338 Canada, even though we have more writings than 338. They're showing all these things about why one should vote for a particular party, because going back to the strategic aspect of it. In terms of polling and how they should be reported, I guess you do have to look at that margin of error, and if the number is too high, I guess you can discount that automatically. Is that how you go about reading polls, say?
That's how I look at it. The other thing, and I interviewed Philip Fournier for the book, because when I started that chapter, I was so annoyed at pollsters, I just wanted to say no polls during elections. Let's get them out of here. And I talked to Philippe Fournier because he's the founder of 338, even though it's 343 now. And he convinced me polls have a role to play. He said, Joanne, even if polls weren't published, the parties would all do polls and they would know. And I said, you're right. And he said, it's like a hockey game. At some point, you have to know the score at this stage of the game. And I said, okay, I can see the value of that. But I said, Philippe, the public don't understand the difference between a poll that was done on a certain day in a certain area and what Philippe does, which is called, you know, an aggregator. He has an algorithm, much like, you know, a Facebook algorithm, that models what the history of the riding, the population, what all the polls say, and they literally do an update every few days on their model. And that's where all those little lines come from. You know, you see a red line and a blue line and the graph that we all look at. If you look at those graphs, because Philippe is very, very willing to put his margin of error on his model at the top, often it's 8 or 9%.
Yeah.
And that's either way. It could be 8% less or 8% more. And when you start at factoring that in, you realize anything could happen in this riding. And Philippe would agree with you because I listen to his podcast quite a bit, and he'll say, well, you know, we think we know this is happening right now. What we know is a trend, and that's it. But the parties and individuals and your friends on Facebook use it as if it's gospel. And that has to change. So I recommend, and I'm not sure that pollsters are going to love me for this, but I recommend that we not be able to publish during an election campaign any poll that has a margin of error greater than 5%, so that we're at least putting a cap on, you know, how wide the range can be. And this was suggested to me by a reader of the book, and I kind of like the suggestion. We have a blackout on advertising 24 hours before the vote.
Yeah.
So you have to pull all your ads and all that sort of thing. Someone said, what if we had a blackout on polls, say, 3 days before the vote, so that the last poll in this case would be Friday, and you couldn't have any polls again until voting day? And something about that appeals to me, partially because it would just reduce the amount of noise from the polls. Because right now, I've never seen an election with so much talk about polls.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I mentioned in my question was misinformation, and there is a chapter in the book where you talk about just the misinformation, and you give American examples, of course, which we're seeing a lot of. In the book, you suggest a role for Elections Canada in terms of, say, the messages that we're getting from campaigns especially. There is a role for them, I guess. Is that what you suggest?
Well, that's my feeling. And it's, again, policing is hard. The good news is you can count on the political parties to rat out each other. So if it was a complaint-based system, I think it would have some value. What I say is that political parties do not fall under the Truth in Advertising Act. And so they can, I hate to say lie, because most of them would say they don't lie. They just maybe don't tell you all the story.
Right.
But I think that if something is not true, you should have a consequence for it. You should have to either pull down the advertising, or you should have to correct it, or you should have some kind of repercussions from out and out saying something that is not true. And if it is true, you have to prove it's true. And I think that should apply across the board. One place where they've tried to start this is New Brunswick, where if you make a promise in your campaign, and so the leader or a candidate says something, you have to say, I can cost it and give the cost, or I don't know what the cost is, and you have to register it with Elections New Brunswick.
Mm.
Now, I can't say that everybody's rushing to that site to look at that, but it does make political parties stop and think about making promises they don't plan to keep, because it's right there that you knew how much it would cost, or you thought you did, and or it's a promise you just pretended you were just pulling out of your hat. And as the other political parties are starting to really pick up on that, and so I think it has reduced the amount of wild promises that people make in New Brunswick. I think we should take that further.
Yeah.
I think we should start to say, you've got to have some hope of doing it. And there should be some consequence if you make a promise, even if it's true, and you don't keep it. I'm thinking of, you know, this will be the last election under first past the post,
right.
A promise that was made 1,200 times in that campaign. There were no consequences to not keeping that promise. And I think at some point that's a flaw. Maybe it's accounting to a committee about why the promise wasn't kept, and then that committee, a committee of the parliament, having some ability to sanction a party, much like a commissioner, an ethics commissioner. Like, there has to be something. Otherwise, what good are the promises?
Yeah. In that chapter, you also talk about the importance of public broadcasting. And I can't help but think how having strong journalism, a strong culture of media, say, in this country, and especially with public broadcasting, at the center, would be good at combating that misinformation.
Well, I think it's essential, and I think this is an issue we are debating in this campaign. And so you don't have to take my word for it. You can probably go read lots of very eloquent people on the value of public broadcasting to democracy. And in this time of not knowing the source of much journalism and having many of our journalistic outlets owned by large corporations,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not saying they don't do good work, because they do. We have a lot of great journalists working for big corporations. But the value of having a public broadcaster that is independent of corporate interests is that you have something to measure the others against.
Yeah.
Right? That, to me, is a value. This is not saying, the CBC is better than anybody else. That's not what I'm trying to say here. What I'm trying to say is you need some organization that is arm's length from the corporate interests. And it's an argument I would have with Mr. Poliev, who wants to defund the CBC. If you do that, you're saying the marketplace will tell you what's news, and that isn't working for us. That is not working for us, and unfortunately, it will simply increase the amount of misinformation and disinformation and make it harder for good journalists, no matter who they work for, to be able to say, I have to do this story because the CBC is already doing it, or I need to be able to follow up on this source because it's already in the public interest, in the public domain.
Another thing that you talk about in the book that I just found fascinating is on fixed election dates. I think every province and federally, there's a statute that says that the election date, an election should be held at such and such a date after the last election. And yet, we can cite so many things that even after the book's been published of, Ontario's gone to the polls, and even this federal election, I guess, it should have been in the fall, right?
Well, I use, there are two that stand out that came out after the book was mm-hmm. done. Nova Scotia went to the polls quickie, 6 months before they had to, in December, December 9th. Now, I don't know about you, but I am not thinking politics on December 9th.
Yeah.
And the turnout was 45%. 45%. Nova Scotians love to vote, just want to point that out. And why was that? I think, personally, yes, it was December. But secondly, they thought the premier would not have called an election if he thought he was going to lose. So he has a poll that tells him he's going to win. Why do I bother voting? They know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of cynicism that comes out when you just kick fixed election dates to the curb. Same thing happened with Doug Ford. You know, he realized that, Canada's not for sale hats really were doing it for him. He decided to quickly go to the polls, and again, a 45% turnout in February in Ontario, and, he wins. Yes, both Tim Houston and Doug Ford get big majorities, but at what cost? I mean, 18 or 20% of their population actually voted for them, so their mandates, in my opinion, aren't even really valid, but even more so, they've added to the cynicism of voters.
I was going to ask you for predictions for Monday night, but just in terms of voter turnout, do you think it's going to be as high as 2015?
I think it is. I'm very hopeful. And if it's not, I will be so disappointed because it will mean that the committed core got out early and people like voting on holidays.
Yeah.
So I hope that people are not paralyzed by the talk of strategic voting and that they're actually energized by the amount of interest and the fact that this has been an election about Canadian sovereignty and issues that people can really, really feel are important enough that they must vote. I think, the NAFTA election in 1988 was like that.
Mm.
It was an issue that was big enough that people felt they had to turn out for it. And I think that, we look back at the NAFTA election and it had a 75% turnout. That was now, can we do that again? I don't think we can get quite to that, but boy, I'd be excited if we did. And I, as someone who's written a book on getting people out to vote, I won't be disappointed if we get a good turnout. I'll feel that, some of the things I hope for, it'll show it's possible.
Now, if it's a high voter turnout and it means that a couple of the parties lose seats, say,
yeah,
not the two major ones, for example.
No, but the NDP, the Greens,
yeah,
maybe even the Bloc, yeah.
What do you think that means for the result then and where the country's headed in the next I'm assuming it's going to be majority government, but I shouldn't even assume that. It could be
a minority either way.
So the next 2 years, say.
What does it mean? I think we'll all have to sit down and think about that. I suspect this is a bit of an anomaly. Our next election won't be like this one. And I think that what I hope is that those parties have enough votes to let them stay in existence. We know that, the Conservatives were once down to two seats and they've come back. The Liberals were in double digits and have come back. This will be hard on certainly the NDP and the Greens. But I think that, I hope that they go back in with enough of a percentage of the vote that they can start to rebuild, that they will continue to hold the two major parties to account, and that they will rebuild for the next election. I really hope that that's the case. I hope they don't get wiped out to the point where there is no funding available,
yeah,
that it all has to be done by fundraising. It'd be very generous of a majority government to bring back the per-vote federal subsidy so that each vote in this country is worth, you know, $1.50, $1.75 to the party that gets it. Because that would ensure we have a vibrant, healthy, multi-party democracy.
And you've been signing books and meeting people on that part of on that side of the country, as well as on this side of the country. Recent travels out here in Vancouver and Victoria. People are taking to this, the messages in the book, aren't they?
They are. I mean, of course, every author's thrilled when people go, I agree with you on this, or this really speaks to me. I mean, we're having lots of discussion about proportional representation and whether there should be a major change in the system. But what I think people are saying is that the concept of let's do whatever we can to help people reconnect to their vote, that's resonating. That's resonating, especially new voters. Voters between 18 and 34, because if we lose that cohort, we will, you know, and only of the advanced polls, only 13% were between 18 and 34. It's not a big turnout, right? When you consider the over 65 was 25%. So, yes, this is resonating. People care about our voter turnout being down, and they want to see something done to encourage people to vote more.
And you can start by encouraging, say, one or two people to go with you or
go with you?
Yeah.
Take your kids so they see you voting. And I know lots of parents are doing that now, and that really encourages me. Maybe speak to the 20-year-old down the street and say, hey, are you going to vote? Well, I don't know. Well, come on, I'll take you. Right? Like, just think what that means to a young person. Because often it's because they don't know what happens when you vote. They're a little leery about it, right? And you can have a great conversation with a niece or a nephew or, you know, someone else in your family, an aunt or an uncle who you'd like to get to the polls. I think that's really, really important. And I actually think it can do a great deal to make our country much more connected to each other, as opposed to the polarization, which we're hearing so much, that divides us. You know, my mother's generation, they all knew someone who was lost in the war fighting for the right to vote. They would never miss an election. I think women sometimes know that, you know, those who went before us fought hard for the right to vote, and it would be insulting of me to those women if I didn't vote. But we're losing that touchstone with history, right? Young women today think that women have always voted, right?
Yeah.
They don't know that people went to war about this. So, yeah, I think talk to somebody about how important it is to just vote.
Well, congratulations on this book, Joanne. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. It's such an engaging book and an important one. I hope a lot more people pick up the book, and I hope a lot more people vote on Monday. Thanks for this.
Me too. Thank you so much, and thanks for reading the book and enjoying it. I really appreciate the feedback. Bye, Joe.
The book is called Storm the Ballot Box, An Insider's Guide to a Voting Revolution. It's published by Nimbus. Its author, Joanne Roberts, joined me on the line from Halifax in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.